Good morning. It's always so great to come to Chukoji because, like, your Heart Sutra is the one that I learned 25 years ago, but don't do anymore. So I have to remind myself, oh yes, what was the old version? Mm-hmm. Because you're still doing that. I love that. But then we do something like this, and it's exactly the same as the one we're doing. And I'm expecting it to be different. So it's so great, because you just keep coming up against your expectations all day long. So thank you for doing some things the same and finding some things differently. So my name is Misha, and I have a small lay group that hangs out in sort of the Menlo Park, Redwood City, Woodside area. On Saturdays, we're at the Home Zendo at my home in Woodside, which is about 20 minutes down the road. And on Monday evenings, we are in Menlo Park in the gym behind the school where I work. So it's all rather incestuous. But the good news is that we have a place to sit. And even though it isn't quite as big and lovely as yours, I just love this new stuff you've done. The Shoji screens are beautiful. But it is a place to practice, and for that I am very, very grateful. And our group on Saturdays is about this size, sometimes a little bit bigger, and we have a smaller place, so it's very crowded, which is also kind of fun. Where are we going to sit today? It's musical chairs. But always be grateful for this lovely space that you have had for so many years and that so many bodhisattvas made for you to be able to sit here today, and some of whom are, I know, sitting in this room, made it possible. I think it's easy to forget when we walk in the door that while we've just walked in the door, people have been walking in the door for years and years before us to make this possible. So just to remember to be filled with gratitude for all the Buddha's ancestors that have gone before. So anyone who knows me for any length of time knows that one of my very favorite places to visit is Hawaii. And I was very fortunate during the holidays to be able to go yet again to Maui. And there are many, many things that I love about the islands. Of course, in the dead of winter, being out from under the redwoods and the rain and the drip is always very nice. Although, of course, that didn't happen this year. And the smell of the plumeria blossoms in the air the moment you step off the airline. It's just all of a sudden every bone and muscle in your body relaxes and you realize you've been scrunched up with the cold of winter for weeks and weeks. But especially in my early visits, there was a feeling, a spirit there in the people and in the way of life that I always very much appreciated. It used to be around here as well, but I'm afraid that in the hustle and bustle and the rise of technology in this area, the spirit of what they call aloha is somewhat lacking these days. And in fact, I had one of my students yesterday, one of my Zen students, come back from Paris and say, you know, the French are so polite and courteous. And I'm thinking, wow, we have really gone downhill if the French are polite next to us. So something is wrong with this picture. But many years ago, a nephew of mine and his wife had visited Hawaii, and they loved it so much that when they went to get married a year later, they wanted their wedding to have a Hawaiian theme. And so I went online, because I finally learned how to do it, and looked up aloha, because I wanted, as a representative of my family, to be able to say something that was in that spirit. And I was stunned to find out that aloha has actually been written into the Hawaiian state constitution. It is a law, the aloha spirit. So there's a professor of Hawaiian culture, and he wrote a paper called Aloha, A Concept for Living. And he said, Most people have probably heard the Hawaiian word aloha as a greeting, farewell, or as a word meaning love. Actually, aloha embodies a deep and wonderful spiritual and social concept at the heart of Hawaiian culture. Saying aloha is nice, but understanding it and living it is even better. In 1986, the Hawaiian State Legislature passed the Aloha Spirit Law. Much of its text is worth repeating here as it gives some real insight into the meaning of the concept. So first of all, I found out that they made aloha into an acronym. Each letter stands for something. Okay. So here's what it says. The aloha spirit is the coordination of mind and heart within each person. It brings each person to the self, capital S. Each person must think and emote good feelings to others. In the contemplation and presence of the life force, aloha, the following unui laula loa, free translation, may be used. A. Akahai, meaning kindness to be expressed with tenderness. L. Lokahi, meaning unity to be expressed with harmony. O. Olu olu, meaning agreeable, to be expressed with pleasantness. Ha 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 ha. I said it wrong again. It's hard not to add the ha ha in there. Ha 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 ha, meaning humility, to be expressed with modesty. And the last A, ahonui, meaning patience, to be expressed with perseverance. So this is part of what I was saying to them and what I wished for them for their married life together. But what I was so struck by at the time was how Buddhist this sounds. How much like our own practice. I mean, that part about it brings each person to the self. They could have been reading straight out of Dogen. So really, I'm struck by the aloha spirit not being any different from really what we're doing in Zen practice. So if you think about the first one, akahi, kindness, this is related to our sutra, the Metta Sutta, on loving kindness. And it includes that whole compassion and generosity, all of those qualities that either the six paramitas or the Eightfold Path talk about in terms of right speech, right action. So recently, I think this is really amusing. Those of you who know me know that my husband is not a practicing Buddhist, even though he gives up his home to all of us on Saturdays and leaves at 5 o'clock in the morning to go golf, sometimes with Michael. But all of a sudden, he sends me a little email with a forward, and he says, "So I've gone onto the Dalai Lama's website." Really? And I found this, and I thought you'd be interested. I am now on Facebook with the Dalai Lama. I'm thinking, wow, he may not be practicing, but he's a Buddhist. Okay. But here's what the Dalai Lama wrote that day that he thought I'd be interested in. It's lovely. It fits right in here. The Dalai Lama wrote, "Generosity is the most natural outward expression of an inner attitude of compassion and loving kindness. When one desires to alleviate the suffering of others and promote their well-being, then generosity in action, word, and thought is this desire put into practice. It is important to recognize the generosity here refers not just to giving in the material sense, but to generosity of the heart." Here's our practice right here. And as somebody said recently, she was talking about her teacher, Maha Maharshi, and she said, "You know, Baba used to say that you had to, you know, love everyone as yourself, as your teacher, as your guru." She said, and I don't think he meant just the people you got along with, that he meant you had to love everybody that way. And that is true generosity. it's really easy to be generous and kind and wish loving kindness to those people who are good to us and nice to us. But boy, you know, we all have people in our life that we find difficult. And to wish them that is a whole new deal. That takes a lot of practice. So the second one, the L, Lokahi, which they call unity. Here we are in emptiness, the Heart Sutra. Our interdependence. There is no such thing as just me. There's no such thing as just you. There is even no such thing as just this cup. Everything is interconnected, and right now the cup and I are together because I'm holding it. And when I drink the water, at what point does the water become me? I mean, we're 96% water, right? But does it happen as it's going down my throat? Does it happen when it's in my stomach? I can't say. All I can say for sure is that we're together. The water and I are together. At some point, the water and I are not together, and the water evaporates out of my skin, or I urinate, and then the water is something else that looks separate, but actually isn't. So this unity, this interdependence, this is what helps us create harmony. The understanding that we aren't separate, that even that person that we consider to be our enemy is actually in some ways our best friend. Because whatever is coming up for us around them is our response. They're not responsible for our response. They're doing their own thing. So, this is, you know, in the tea room, you know, I study tea ceremony, as many of you have been aware. And in the tea room, this unity, this interdependence is very, very obvious. It's built into it. From the moment you come into the tea room, you know, there's a scroll and a flower. And the scroll and the flower are supposed to be about the season. They're supposed to represent something that has to do with either the individuals invited or the time of year. Already, we're connecting the outside world with the inside room of tea. And then on the tea bowl, there's always what's called a beauty spot. It could just be where the glaze drips down more in one place than another. It could be an actual mark made by the potter. But when that tea bowl, when I'm putting tea and making tea in that bowl, that beauty spot faces me. The bowl and I are interdependent. But when I go to give it to my guest, I turn it in my hand so that now that beauty spot is facing my guest. So I invite the tea person into relationship then with the bowl. But then in a funny way, all three of us are in connection because I'm still in connection with the bowl. And that is the way it is in our real life. Whatever we might think, even if you don't all know each other, which you may, but you may not, you are all in connection in this moment because, quite frankly, you're all breathing the same air. And if nothing else, when does that air leave Nora and become Diane? You know, at what point can I claim it? I can't. But it's all connected. It's all intertwined. What makes us crazy, actually, is thinking that it's all separate, and then we feel very alone. So the Hawaiians understand this, and they say, no, 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 no. Lokahi, unity, harmony. Right? The third one's a little harder to make the relation, except that I think it happens naturally. This is the one, olu, olu, being agreeable. In our practice, I think that the way we learn how to be agreeable is in the practice of skillful means, upaya. Because there are some people who would like to tell you the truth, and they would like to hit you over the head with it. That's not very skillful. It may be the truth, but you're so hurt by it, you can't hear it anymore. Or it makes you angry, and then you push back. So there are ways of speaking, ways of doing something. And mostly what we do with our skillful means, is be inclusive. So, at least for a little while longer, I've been acting as a Dharma teacher at IMC, the Vipassana Center in Redwood City, for what we call the tweens. They don't particularly care for the title, but they're not teens yet, but they're not little kids either. It's like the 11, 12-year-olds. And we were talking about decision-making, because we're about to come up with a new title, because they don't like tweens. It's fine. So we talked about all different kinds of government and decision-making processes until we came to consensus, the consensus model. And there was a little small altar in the center of the circle in which there was the apricot-colored rose. And I said, okay, so let's just take the rose as our decision-making here. Let's say that five of you really love the color of that rose, and yes, let's have that rose from now on for the altar. But one of you says, you know what, I absolutely despise that color. So now we have five who are for, one who is really against, and no one in the middle. So there's no stand-aside. There's an actual block. Someone says, no, I am never having that flower in my altar. What do you do? And it was really interesting because one girl said, well, it could be majority rules. I said, yeah, it could be. That's not the consensus model, but that's a possible way of deciding things. What if you decided to do the consensus model, though, where in the long run, everybody gets included in the decision? And it was so great because this 11-year-old boy says, well, we could talk about it. I said, boy, if the government would be listening to you right now, we wouldn't be in the state we're in. Talk about it. Find out, what is it about this color that you find objectionable? Is there another color we could use? I said, you know, obviously the big decisions are a lot harder to do than choosing the color of a flower. But having that conversation, using skillful means to come to a decision, being agreeable. This is how we create harmony in the world. This is how we make good decisions, how we include everyone. Because our situation in the Zendo is that everyone's sitting on their own cushion individually, and yet we're all sitting in the same room together. So if one person in the room is doing something really bizarro, all the rest of the people in the group are being affected. So we all kind of agree to do the same thing. We agree to walk in the same direction. Think about Kim Hyun and no direction at all. Everybody's just wandering around the room. You can do it, but it's a little chaotic. So we agree we're always going to go in this direction. And in every Zendo you go, this is the direction you go in. In fact, it's very funny. My group back in New York, when I first got there, I think the first or second time, I realized they were going the other direction. I was like, what are you guys doing? And they're like, what do you mean, what are we doing? We're going the wrong way. I said, what do you mean the wrong way? I said, well, let's put it this way. You're not doing what all the other Zen centers are doing, so turn it around. There is no wrong way and right way. Just about on anything, there really isn't. But there is the way that we agree to do it so we can do it together. That's the agreeable thing. So the Hawaiian people, as a people, understand that. And family is extremely important to them for that reason. So then there's the H in aloha. Ha, ha, ha. Humility. Westerners do not much care for this word. There's false humility. People always tell you how... I'm always reminded of Dickens. Oh, I'm an humble man. I'm so humble. They're telling you they're humble. That's not what we're talking about. Humility, as which is demonstrated with modesty, is not putting yourself before others. We actually have a precept that's kind of not praising self over others. But the best phrase that I was ever given, which was given to me specifically as a teaching and a practice, for good reason, was to be a white bird in snow. It's okay to be a bird. It's okay to be flapping around a little. But when you're a white bird in snow, you're not really seen that much, and you don't need to be seen. And in fact, actually, maybe the snow is this wonderful camouflage where you can do your work without needing to be seen. I think when I first came to Zen practice, I had a really big need to be seen. So you make a big deal out of things, or you have to do everything perfect, or you have to be telling everyone else how to do it perfect. When you have been around practice long enough, you realize how wonderful it is to step back. And the other phrase is you practice secretly. You practice in stealth. You do, it's that bumper sticker, random acts of kindness. You're not running around telling everybody how kind you're being. You just do things because it's the right thing to do with no expectation of recognition. That is the mature Zen student. That is one of the things when I'm teaching my students or watching them, that's what I'm looking for. When do they finally realize they don't need to be thanked anymore? I mean, that's not to say I'm not going to. It's that they don't need it. They don't need the recognition. They're doing it because that's the way we treat each other. That's what we do. So then the final A in aloha, aho nui, patience. And I love the fact that they say as expressed with perseverance, because I don't know about the rest of you, but this is where the rubber hits the road for me. I grew up in a very impatient family. I became an impatient person. And it took me years to realize that, unfortunately, one of the outcomes of impatience is anger. I saw the anger earlier than I saw the impatience. I finally saw the anger in me. And I worked and worked and worked to get a hold on it. And then I finally had to say, well, what are the causes? What are the root causes for me? What is pushing my buttons that causes my anger to arise? And I realized suddenly, whoa, you have no patience. You're always in a hurry, and you want it done a certain way, mostly your way. And that makes it hard to include other people. And it was at that moment that I heard an old tape in my head, in my mother's voice, and I love my mother and we're very close, but it's an old tape. If you want a job done right, you have to do it yourself. This is because, first of all, you're too impatient to let anybody else do it. And second of all, you're convinced that you have the right way of doing it. And thirdly, that you're not interested in inclusion. Our whole practice is about not two, not one. When we really deeply understand our interdependence, we want to include everyone. So, patience, it's actually quite wonderful that I work with small children because they are a patience practice. And I was really shown this. Last year was a very challenging year for me because one of my dearest friends, I think I mentioned this before, had a stroke. And so from May until December, when we finally got her moved back into her home, she passed her driver's test, she started working again. She's the miracle child for stroke victims. But it was a very long and full 7 months. And I was very involved in her care. So that meant that when I started school in September, I was pretty exhausted. Usually I have a less busy summer. I'm still doing my Zen teaching, but I'm not teaching at school. So I have a little more rest time to prepare myself for the beginning of the school year. Of course, the kids have done nothing all summer except have a good time and play and go places, and they come back in September and they're all, energetic. And I came back in September really tired. And I was just sort of crawling towards the winter break. Then I went to Hawaii. And I had these almost 2 weeks of just doing nothing, just reading and walking and swimming, and just wonderful. And I really noticed the difference when I came back in January. That whole first week especially, I was so patient. I was really enjoying these kids with all their noise and their yelling and their running around and, you know, whatever it was they were doing. And I was fine with it. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thing to find out, too. It is more difficult to be patient when we're in a cranky mood, when we're tired, when we're angry, when we are suffering from negative emotions or affliction. So that is a good reason also to take care of ourselves. If we take care of our body, then our mind follows suit. We can be more patient. When we can be more patient, we are less afflicted by negative emotion, which means we won't cause as much harm out in the world. And I'm sure if you talked to those kids, they wouldn't have said, oh yeah, Misha was a real grump for 3 months. Because of practice, you can carry yourself through the day, but you yourself are aware that you're not being quite as open-hearted. And the longer you practice, the more you realize how open-hearted you can be, how here you can be, so that when you're not, even if it's a small amount, you really notice it more. And this is a good thing, to notice it. To become self-aware is really a big part of our practice. It doesn't mean that you're not going to get angry, and it doesn't mean that you're not going to cause harm. What it's going to mean is that you're going to be aware of it. Sometimes you're only aware after you've done it. Sometimes you're aware during it. You know, I'm nagging my husband and I'm realizing as the words are coming out of my mouth, what is wrong with you? What a nasty thing to say. Sometimes, though, you catch yourself, you know, there's that, somebody says something, you just really want that response, but you catch yourself first. No, that wouldn't be helpful. So you don't say it. You back it up. You get better at it. You don't get perfect. It's okay. You are aware of it at least. So, last week, I had a staff meeting at which we had a guest speaker who is a former parent in my school. And she was lecturing on negotiations and communications, how to come to some kind of an agreement with someone that maybe it's difficult to do. And at one point, she was talking about all the different people she's talked to and the group she's talked to and the Greater Goodness Project and other things. But at one point, she talks about this man, Rick Hansen, who apparently is involved with brain meditation and all of that. So she goes to interview him. And at this point, I mean, I'm just sitting there going, okay, you know, I've been teaching this for 20 years, but fine. So she says that she goes to him and she says, yes, but, you know, I want to know what to do with the Macy's man. He says, what? She says, well, you know, the Macy's man. Here's the guy, and you're telling him that your delivery hasn't arrived, and he's waving his arms going, well, it's not my fault, and he's getting really upset. I want to know what to do about him. Now, he starts explaining to her the fundamentals of meditation practice. And she stops, she interrupts, she says, no, I don't want to know how to meditate. I want to know what to do about the Macy's man. At this point, I'm sure he's rolling his eyes inside his head. But what he says to her is, well, you know, there is this practice of big sky mind. I'm sitting there thinking to myself, what? The Macy's man is all over the map, and you're going to say, excuse me, could you just go into big sky mind here for a moment? I don't actually think that's what he was trying to tell her. I think he was trying to tell her that she should go into big sky mind. Because here is the fundamental misunderstanding. We think the problem is out there. We think we can fix this person. We can say some magic word and they're going to just... So I wanted to write her, but I've been waiting because I'm not sure it would be the appropriate thing to do. But I wanted to say, no, you can't fix the Macy's man. The only person you can fix is yourself. Because I would bet that while the Macy's man was getting all distressed and waving his arms, you started mimicking him. You started getting pulled into his distress. And your voice went up and you started, and that just made him get more.
No.
The true metaphor here is the hurricane. The world is a maelstrom. This is a big, giant hurricane going around, and it's filled with partners losing their jobs, children getting into trouble at school, friends being diagnosed with cancer, family members arguing. It's huge. And you get done with one problem, you get it solved, and it, boom, another one appears. And it's going around all the time. It's happening, and the more people you know, I mean, my altar is filled with names of people who are in trouble right now who need vows of well-being. You could easily become part of that maelstrom because the Macy's man is everywhere, and he's reaching in to grab you, but you are standing in the center of the hurricane. This is what our practice is. Because the center of the hurricane is absolutely calm. There's even sun, I hear, in the center of the hurricane. Your work is to stay there and pull the Macy's man gently into you, rather than being yanked out every time a Macy's man comes into your life. Now, I say this, and it is really hard to do, because our practice of sitting, zazen, is years and years of practicing calm, stable sitting. Clear mind, just here, over and over. Mind keeps going away. You bring it here, here, here. So that when we go out there, and the motorcyclist passes us on the blind curve, and the car is coming in the other direction, and you are mortally afraid that you don't completely flip out and go off into the maelstrom. But you stay calm, and you take a deep breath. Okay, he made it this time. Because next time, he might not. And then you have to be in a calm state to do what needs to be done next. There's nothing worse than having something go wrong and everybody being panicked and upset and angry and crazy. What you're looking for is the calm person, because they will know what to do next. So, while I was in Hawaii, I did not follow my own advice. I was at Black Rock. We were going to park in the parking lot. It's a very small parking lot to get out to this area, which is supposedly good for snorkeling. And when we drove in, there were no parking spots, and my husband was driving and was starting to back up to make a Y turn to go back out. And unbeknownst to us, there was a car in the parking lot backing up. And as he's backing up, all of a sudden he says, "No, stop!" And I look out my window and see this, and I yell at the top of my voice, "Stop!" But they have their speakers on so loud, the music is so loud, they can't hear us, and they crash into the back end of our car. Rather than taking a deep breath, calming myself and staying in the middle of the hurricane, my husband and I both get out, and it's like, "Oh, no. Didn't you guys hear us yelling?" And then immediately, well, of course we didn't hear you yelling. Why are you backing up into us?" Finally, I got a hold of myself. I said, "Look, let's just exchange information here." And the problem was that the other guy, it was his older brother's car. And of course, he was upset because he knew his older brother was going to be really mad. And he said one more really provoking thing. And at that point, I said, "Look, we could call the cops if you want. I don't want to, but if that's what it takes," and I'm sure I had an edge in my voice, And with that, the guy from the hotel that was next door that has something to do with this parking lot comes, and he says, yes, that's a good idea, let's call the police. So then we had to waste the policeman's time and have a whole accident report, and it was not an amicable situation. And I felt kind of bad because I thought, oh, great, this is not exactly the aloha spirit. I got pulled out of my center. I got drawn into the maelstrom of, you hit my car, and my brother's going to be really pissed off, and I'm going to get in trouble. And instead of just very calmly saying, look, it doesn't matter who's at fault. Let's just exchange our information and let the insurance companies work it out. Because the great thing is, they had insurance, and so did we. It would have made it so much nicer. And instead, everybody went away mad. And I'm sure they're thinking, oh, those howlies from the mainland. So as I say, it's easy to talk about this. And I do try to keep this metaphor in my mind, staying in my calm center. But the Macy's man is out there. And we have to be ready. We have to be ready at all times. The emergency is now. So, the Aloha Spirit Law goes on to say, these are traits of character that express the charm, warmth, and sincerity of Hawaii's people. It was the working philosophy of Native Hawaiians and was presented as a gift to the people of Hawaii. Aloha is more than a word of greeting or farewell or a salutation. Aloha means mutual regard and affection and extends warmth and caring with no obligation in return. Aloha is the essence of relationships in which each person is important to every other person for collective existence. Aloha means to hear what is not said, to see what cannot be seen, and to know the unknowable. This is a law. Don't you love it? I wish this was the law of the entire United States, right? This last part is sheer dogan. To hear what is not said, to see what cannot be seen, to know the unknowable, this is our practice of emptiness. Eiken Roshi used to say that Zen practice was actually about the formation of character. That's what they're saying here. These are traits of character. The longer you practice, the finer a character you have. You are confident and you are kind because you're not always thinking about yourself or your own desires. So the best example that I had of this during my stay, 3 days before we were to leave, the weather was wetter and windier than it usually is, and often we go walking on the beach at night near our hotel. But we hadn't really been able to because it was so wet. But finally, the weather changed, and that night was the first night, and we decided to go for a walk. We get down to our beach, and it's pretty dark, and I almost walk into this cord across the beach. I'm like, what is this? And only then do I realize that a third of the beach is cordoned off, and in the middle of it is this giant thing. We're looking, it's a seal. I don't know how many of you know about monk seals, but they're very rare. There are only 1,100 of them left in the world. Most of them hang out in the little archipelago above Hawaii. Some are in Oahu and some in Kauai, but they almost never come to Maui. And here is this beautiful 350-pound female monk seal on the beach. And there are volunteers there already, and they've cordoned off. And normally the perimeter is 500 yards in any direction. But it's a small beach, and they know that the owners of the hotel will have a fit if they do that. So it's 50 feet. I am 50 feet from this creature. She's beautiful. She's enormous. And she's there, apparently after a long sea journey, because she's sound asleep and has been in that position since 2 o'clock in the afternoon. We hang out for a while. We go home. Next morning at 6 o'clock, we get up. We walk back down. She's still there. She's just having a great old time, snooing away every now and then. She sneezes. she opens up an eye and she goes back to sleep. We're thrilled. We're just sitting and sitting. At some point, I sort of went into a Zazen trance just watching her. There's nothing else to do, right? And then at 9:30, absolutely right on the dot, she wakes up and says, oh, time to go. Within half a minute, she has humped herself down the beach, into the water, gone. Oh, it was beautiful. It was thrilling. It is always thrilling to be around a truly wild animal who has no consciousness of you, nor is showing off in any way. It's just there. But the thing that I found wonderful was that on every single island, there is a group of volunteers. They get a call in the middle of the night, they go to set up this perimeter to keep stupid people from bothering it so that this creature can rest and do what she needs to do. They don't expect your thanks. They're incredibly knowledgeable. They were talking to us, telling us anything we wanted to know. And then when the seal's gone, they pick up their things and they go home. Remember that part of no obligation? It says, aloha means mutual regard and affection and extends warmth and caring with no obligation in return. These people don't expect to be thanked. They love these seals because they understand interdependence. When the monk seals die, part of us does too. And it's the same with everything. And this is why we value life so much and why it is the very first precept. No killing, if you can possibly avoid it. So, the aloha spirit is the coordination of mind and heart within each person. So I say aloha to each of you. Please pass it on, because it is actually the Zen spirit as well. Thank you.